accession number 10167, reel 2.
Ronald Elliott, Reel 2. How did you get on with the rest of the training squad you were in?
Usually I find I get on quite well with men, into the camaraderie of it, which is most important. And I'd had the experience of being in a shipyard, and in one sense that was, you know, somewhat a precursor of what it was like in a back room. The language was just about the same, and the talk was about the same. And I guess, coming from my background, I was sort of a latent middle class, really, at that time. But I'd had working class background, and I knew the working class, so I could get on, I suppose, with the working class. Although I wouldn't have preferred, really, to be part of a working class group if I could have avoided it, but this is how it was. But one of the important aspects of the intake was, and this sort of reflected itself throughout the army career to a large extent, was that it was generally composed of two sorts of people. One were quite young, the 18-year-olds, and there were also enlisting quite old people who were in the 30s. And later on, as we see in the service career, you were tending either to have people who were contemporary with you in your age group or quite older people who had families or whatever. And I found that there was this mixture worked quite well because they had a knowledge and an experience that sort of tended to counteract any sort of callousness that we had as youngsters and the experience of the two together worked quite well. And although they had a lot more, I think, to lose in, say, the basic training, they were a much more amenable crowd in that they accepted it more patiently with fortitude. And therefore, they were a great help to the younger ones. And I think they were a good help also in sort of the barrack room atmosphere.
I was going to ask about that. Within the atmosphere, was there any bullying within the group? Not from the Lance Corporal, but was there any?
There were always people who were butts somehow or other, who were, you know, totally unsuited in one way or another, and we had the odd one or two, and they would be bullied at times, but provided everyone sort of supported the bullied person, the sort of downtrodden, which tended to happen. I don't know that anybody had their life made an absolute misery by any members of the group as such, because we had this fierce feeling that the real enemy were the outside NCOs and the whole of the establishment, and that therefore we had to stick together and not try and cause too much problems amongst ourselves. So, generally speaking, there was an understanding that we tried to protect one another, and there was this feeling of camaraderie going on.
How about the lack of privacy of barrack life? How did that affect you?
Well, it's something that, you know, you hardly ever became used to. It's noisy. There's nowhere to go except at those times you could go to the naffy, or they used to have quiet reading rooms or whatever, but you became accustomed to that. You could write letters and whatever, and I think I can do that now. I mean, I used to do a lot of work with the radio on full blast, and it didn't bother me later on in life because I'd grown accustomed to being able to detach what's going on. And what you never, I think, totally become used to is the noise at night people are making. I mean, I suppose it's quite the same in prison where people are coughing and snorting and snoring and belching, and if they've been drinking, farting and all sorts of things. And it's very noisy indeed. And you find it difficult to get to sleep. When you do, at some stupid early hour in the morning, there's a bugler blows, and, you know, that really was the worst feature of it all in the morning. The bugle calls, I mean, they struck terror into me even now, I think.
Could you take me through a typical day of the training, you know, as the day went through, in these early, this early first 4 or 5 weeks?
Timing would be pretty difficult to remember.
Oh, not the exact times, I just mean...
But you'd be up early in the morning, say, about 6:30, something like that, I guess. The corporal would go around, kicking you out of bed, knocking you out of bed with his truncheon or whatever it was he had, if you didn't get up, telling you to get out of your pits and this sort of thing. So you'd then toddle across. You usually slept in your singlet and pants, and then you'd get yourself dressed and wander off to the ablutions and have a shave in the cold. You could very well have PT first. I mean, this sometimes happened, you had PT before that. Very likely you would do then. I'm not quite sure whether it happened later or not. Anyway, you'd have PT at some stage, probably in the cold or the wet or whatever. After you'd that, you'd washed and shaved and suitably physic-dipped into sort of something like life. You had a meal which wasn't very exciting. Lumpy porridge, bacon with fried bread that was like hard crusts of rusk or something like that. You know, very fatty. Or eggs, or scrambled eggs, sausages sometimes, and bread and tea. And of course, one ate it. You were so hungry that you ate it. And then you'd have your first parade, and you'd have to get out on parade, perhaps with all of your kit or most of your kit, so that had to be in good order on parade. Might even be inspected by somebody at that stage. And then you would have further parades, which could be marching on the parade ground, learning to march and turn and this sort of thing. You could have drills with or without weapons, and then you'd have weapon discussions. You'd have lectures on weaponry, how to take apart a Bren gun and this sort of thing.
Which weapons were you taught in?
The rifle was a Lee Enfield rifle, I recall, in those days. We had both Lee Enfield and Ross early on. The Ross was, I think, an American thing, but the Lee Enfield was something that we had for most of the time during the war. And Bren guns, grenades, and the various mortars. There was a 2-inch mortar. Don't about the Piat, I think. Piat was certainly there later on, whether we were taught it or not. And then, of course, you would fire them. There would be.
You had practical experience in all
yes.
these things.
You would go out to the rifle range, and every recruit had to do a certain amount of firing. There were so many rounds you had to fire, and had to fire at your targets and things. And that took some time, because they were called butt parties. There'd be a party that would be actually firing, and then there'd be another party that were in the butts indicating where the actual bullets had gone. And that was quite exciting. We would also have inoculations and vaccinations and things.
Sticking to the various weapons, how did you fare in your training with the rifle?
I was a rotten shot. I was quite a rotten shot, I think.
Do you know why? Was it that they weren't training you?
Oh, no, or was it just? It was me. It was. I don't think my eyes are all that good. I found the sort of situation was that I was no good without my spectacles, and with my spectacles, it was very difficult to fire particularly well, because it involved getting you right down to the sights and things. So no, but I don't think I was a very good shot either way.
How about grenade throwing, that sort of, the mortars, how did you...
The grenades used to scare me stiff. I think everybody was, even the, more so, I think it stemmed from the fact that the NCOs weren't very happy, because they were in an even more vulnerable position. At some point in time, they had to give a live grenade to somebody to throw, and you know, they made a mess of it. Also, the NCOs were likely to be in it as well. So, yes, I think everybody was mortally afraid of grenades. You saw what they could do, and you had to fire them. And
were you afraid of the grenade going off early, or were you afraid of the incompetence of yourself or whoever was with you?
It was going off early because you had to prime it, of course, first of all, and the actual fuses, of course, in themselves were quite dangerous. You had to get them in. Then you had to pull out the ring, and then you had to hold it 10 seconds, I think, and then throw it. Well, not 10 seconds, you know. I mean, your heart was in your mouth, really. Then throw it and get down. So, altogether a dodgy business.
So you didn't like that. What about the mortar? The 2-inch, 3-inch mortars? Did you get that on your basic training?
2-inch mortars, I don't think the Pierce. I had a problem with the Pierce mortar later on. I'll tell you about that. But I think it was probably 2-inch mortars. And the other thing that one did was to have bayonet practice as well against dummies. Charging the dummy, pull it out again, charge past, all sort of thing. And you had to really get yourself worked up into some sort of enthusiasm for that. And the NCOs used to chivvy you along and sort of tell you to get stuck. So said, that's a German, get stuck in there, pull your bayonet out.
In the First World War, there was quite a controversy about the bloodthirstiness of the methods used in bayonet training. I mean, the sort of language and what the image they were trying to conjure up in the recruits. Mm. Was that still applying?
Exactly the same, I should imagine. I don't suppose the training changed one moment, really. Yes, it was totally bloodthirsty. You had to get yourself hyped up, charge along. You had to understand that this was a German who, if you didn't kill, would kill you. And you had to shove your bayonet right through him, pull it out again like that, and then go charging on past him. So it was, yes, very bloodthirsty indeed.
Did you think it was relevant to the Second World War, the bayonet training?
Probably not, although there were one or two times when bayonet charges were used. It was after I came to join the battalion at Salerno, but my old company commander got an MC for leading a bayonet charge at Salerno. So it did work. I don't think the Germans were at all happy about our bayonet charges, but of course, you were often not able to use them because they're very much a short-term thing. You had to be that close to be able to get into a bayonet charge and had sufficient numbers to make it worthwhile. I think one factor about the Second World War is that you didn't often have large numbers of people in a small space. It was spread out more. And this was totally different to the First World War.
Did the bloodthirstiness of the training in the bayonet, did it in any way frighten you about facing a bayonet charge or being involved in it? In other words, did the very bloodthirstiness of the training in any way put you off the bayonet?
Oh, yes. You felt that the bayonet was quite a bloodthirsty weapon. In the beginning, they got smaller, but in the beginning it was quite a big thing and it was a huge effort. And yes, one could be very frightened of that. And it led to this feeling that you either had to do something or somebody would do something to you, so you had to get in there first sort of thing.
So you'd have this morning session of training in any of these things that you may... What would lunch be like?
Let me think now. Trying to think whether we had our large meal in the evening or not. It would be a light meal, I think. No, we would have our main dinner meal in the midday. I'm quite certain of that. So you'd perhaps get a soup of some sort, some watery stuff. Then you'd get potatoes and some sort of meat, a stewy arrangement, and things like peas or turnips or cabbage. I mean, totally overcooked. I mean, absolutely desperate. The food in the army was something quite unbelievable. And then some sort of pudding, you know, some sort of thick suet you're putting with.
Could you eat the food all right? I mean, you say it was pretty horrible, but, I mean, what was the quality like behind the bad cooking? Was it good enough? And did you get enough to keep you?
I think you must have got enough. And the quality, I suppose the food originally was quite good. But army cooks the world over, spoil it. But 180, I mean, I didn't in the beginning. I mean, I was totally using my mother wasn't a bad cook at all. And in the beginning one didn't, but later on, because of the outdoor life and because that's all there was. And of course, there was the naffy. I mean, people could go into the naffy and have a meal, which they did in the evening usually. Have some sort of knife and fork thing in the naffy, so you tended to fill up. But you ate it generally. I mean, it was disgusting, but you ate it, I think.
Now, in the afternoon, would you have more training sessions?
Yes, more of the same. Later on, of course, you'd have things like assault courses, which were quite horrible.
During the training?
Yes. Yeah.
Could you tell me about the assault courses, then? An example of what sort of thing they were?
They were quite lengthy and spread out, and would involve, say, jumping over a wide ditch, climbing over brick walls, crawling under things, and you'd be chivied along by all of the NCOs. You might even have to put your respirator on and do some running in a respirator. You'd have to do some bayoneting, all at the double. You'd have to fire at some... And generally at the end, after you were exhausted, you had to fire at some target or other, and you could hardly... I mean, you were so shattered by that time, you could hardly see anything. Well, my glasses were steamed up as rule. And they would be firing, in sort of the advanced training, they'd be throwing crackers at you, sort of sort of simulate war experience. And sometimes, in the more advanced training, they'd have actual live shells being, or live bullets being fired over your head while you were down below.
That wouldn't be during the first five weeks.
No, it wasn't during the first 5 weeks, that was later on. So...
Did you go on route marches?
Yes, yes. Two or three times a week. And they did something else, which I was really found very shattering indeed, was, I forgot what they call it now, but it was a sort of a running walk thing. You were in your denims with boots on, and you would walk for about half a mile, and then you would run for a half a mile, and you'd do this. And that really was very, very tiring, shattering sort of thing. And the route marches were generally with full kit on and weapons, and you would walk for quite prodigious distances.
Did it work? Did it make you fit?
Yes, yes. Well, I was very fit at the end of it. Not perhaps just with that later on. I mean, it was a continuous thing. All of the walking and things, they were necessary, because one did a lot of walking later on.
Did they train you in the history or background of the Royal Engineers to give you some sort of unit pride? Or
I don't recall, actually. There would be some sort of educational courses going on, but I don't now recall very much about them at all.
Did they train you in any of the specialist fields of the of a sapper? I mean,
no,
digging or
no,
anything?
No.
It was just pure infantry?
It was just purely 5 weeks basic infantry training. Later on, the progression was, later on there would be specialist training, which is what happened to everybody. Then it went on to other things.
So after the afternoon session of training, what would tea be?
Tea would be jam or cheese and bread and tea, that sort of thing, something quite light.
And then did you have anything else after that, or were you free? Or
you were free, generally speaking, in the evenings.
What would you do?
You weren't allowed out, this was another, because they thought that you weren't a good enough soldier, you weren't allowed out in the beginning for some weeks until you'd learned, you know, how to wear your uniform properly and salute properly and all this sort of thing. So one couldn't go into Preston, which was the nearest town. But we did go into Preston, say, in the night, or stay in camp where they had a naffy, certainly. I'm not sure about the cinema. I don't think there was then, probably one in town. Because you used to go at the weekends into town.
Did you ever see any of the war films that were coming out, the official government ones and the newsreels of war? Did they affect you at all?
All the newsreels, of course. This is one feature now that one see again in hindsight, that we thought they were totally factual at the time. or factor. But we accepted it was part of the propaganda as well. It was a propaganda exercise. And they did have propaganda films from time to time which one went to see. It was all part of sort of a brainwashing exercise, I guess.
And
we accepted it because, I mean, why not, really? I mean, we were fighting the Germans, and some part of it certainly was true. But what they were doing, I think, which was unfair, was putting a gloss on what was going on, putting on the best face, you know, of all of the various operations. I mean, obviously, for the first half of the war, we were doing pretty badly everywhere, weren't we? But I think they were trying to show as good a picture of that as one could under the circumstances.
Any other recreations? You mentioned the quiet reading room. Would you?
They had sort of snooker and billiards and that sort of thing, and table tennis and what have you.
Was your pay adequate? I mean, were you able to?
It wasn't a lot of money, I don't think. I think I got about 15 shillings, something like that, per week.
We didn't
have a lot to spend it on, you know.
Was there a wet naffy?
Yes.
A beer serving. Would you go there? Did you drink?
No, I didn't drink very much when I was that age. I didn't drink. My father didn't drink, I think, and he didn't smoke either, so he more or less brainwashed me into not doing either. I didn't drink until later on, after I'd been in the army for a while. So we just had tea in the naffy and that sort of thing. One used to get sort of cigarette issues and chocolate issues, and I used to swap, mostly throughout my army career, used to swap my cigarettes for chocolate, and used to get about a couple of bars of chocolate a week, and used to ration myself to that. That was some sort of support, some sort of help towards making life a little more pleasant, I think.
Were you homesick at all during this first period?
Oh, yes.
Did you get letters from home all right?
Yes. The family were very good. They dropped me lines. And that was, you know, great help, actually. Because, I felt totally numb by what was going on. It was such a completely different experience that I was quite shattered. So, it was summer.
You hadn't... Now, the course was coming to an end. Did you move on to tactical training during the course? Or you know, how to advance formations in the field? Did you do any of that?
A wee bit. The sort of exercises. Yeah, you had to be fairly well advanced to be able to do anything like that. Towards the end, I think we did do a bit of that, but not a lot.
What happened at the end of the course? You were there about 5 weeks, which would take you into October 1942.
Yes. We had... on occasion where we were told where we were going to go to, sort of towards the end of our training. And it was the 28th of October, I've got a note, that I was posted away from Preston to... I had to go to Warwick. They told me I was in the Leicestershire Regiment for my pains. Quite why, I don't know. I was in the Leicestershire Regiment.
You don't know why you were transferred from
no,
the RE?
No, I think they just... Well, I was never in the REs, actually. They just happened to run this training battalion. I think that was all it was. And then after your initial training, then you were posted to a particular county regiment, and mine was the Leicesters. I suppose they just went down through the intake and said, well, they're Leicesters and so forth. It had nothing to do where you came from at all.
And you say you were sent to Warwick?
Yes.
That was for signals training.
Mm. I went to S Company in this training battalion at Warwick. I don't know what it is offhand. And we were to do 14-week signal training there in Warwick.
Were conditions of service very different at Warwick?
There was still a certain amount of training going on, but it was noticeably less onerous. We weren't pure infantry as such anyway, although there were some infantry there who were doing more advanced training, I guess. So we also had to do infantry training in addition to our specialist training. But the people were, the NCOs and the officers were noticeably more human in that they were able, I think, not to be quite so harsh, wasn't such a harsh regime. And being trained, we were, to some extent, I think, conditioned now into sort of army life.
What exactly, what were you trained in as signal, in the signals? How did your training go?
We used to do training in Morse code, that was in the tepper, and with a lamp, that was Alder's lamp. So that's pretty old-fashioned. I don't think that was ever needed. We did very little Morse code work subsequently. In wireless sets, and telephone, the army telephones, and cable, and telephone exchanges. And
how detailed was the training?
Oh, it was pretty good. We used to do, every day, we used to do tests in passing messages on Morse code. That is, someone would tap out a message and people would be listening and have to put it down, write it down. And the same with lamps. So that every day we had a buzzer test and a lamp test. And that took best part of the morning. And then we would be doing some other work. And later on, of course, then you did get into tactical exercises because then you were part of the communications network.
You'd have to learn how to repair the equipment.
No. The repair side of it was hardly touched upon at all. It was no part of our responsibilities, generally speaking, to repair the set. This was true when we actually got into.
What about the wires?
Yes, one had to repair cable because that was something that was considered to be within our capabilities. But the actual repair of sets was considered to be a highly technical job, and most of the signals weren't allowed to do that sort of thing.
Did you have any difficulties with learning the basic mechanics of the
Yes, I'm not very good sort of on anything to do with a hand, and I found the actual facility of Morse code very difficult, and I wasn't terribly good at that sort of thing. And towards the end, I wasn't at all sure whether I'd pass all the tests or not, but they somehow managed to do it.
You say you were involved in tactical things as well, you know, exercises. Mm. What sort of things were they doing there?
Well, you could either go out into a field and do it in somewhat a more large-scale effort, or you could do it just within, say, a small area like the barracks areas, where you would each have a radio, a wireless set, and go out, and you'd be all on the same network, and then you would practice that you were doing some attacking, and messages had to be passed backwards and forwards from you to the centre and so forth. So you could do this, you know, as I say, either outside tactically, or you could do it inside without getting involved in any large-scale manoeuvres. But both of these, when we did all sorts of things like that.
Did you notice a difference in the kind of men who were put on signals from the
Yes.
kind of men that had been in the rifle?
Yes. They were, generally speaking, the more intelligent. This was more or less, I think, proven by the fact that I and most of my other contemporaries went on OCTU courses to test whether or not we're officer material, and I went away to Hereford on an OCTU course during this period, and subsequently failed. I was told I had failed, but I could try again if I wanted to.
Well, could you tell me about the OCTU course? What did that consist of? That was Hereford.
Hereford, yes. It was a very pleasant break in otherwise rough army period of time. We went and stayed in this large house, as I remember, in rooms. It was somewhat rather like a country hotel, actually, with lots of other entrants and any number of people who were observing. And one observed during meal times as well. And we had beautiful meals and so forth. And one had in the beginning, intelligence tests, all sorts of intelligence tests and interviews, background, this sort of thing. And then we had practical problems to deal with in groups where one took turns at being the leader of a group to get yourself out of tactical problems and this sort of thing. I think I dropped a clanger with my tactical problems, so wasn't very good at it. And I think probably that I wouldn't have been accepted or acceptable at that point in time in terms of...